All right, welcome to the State of Games, a proud member of the Punchboard Media Content Network. I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm Pinchback 21.
And we are a podcast all about anything and everything related to board and card games and more. Well, welcome to episode 138, or as we like to call it, the one about trend setting, which must obviously be about TC, right?
It is totally about me.
We're going to find out. We're going to find out about trend setting.
The one all about TC.
Isn't that every podcast? I think this was.
I hope so. I hope that's why everyone tunes in, because get ready.
Well, I'm sure that's why some people tune in, because they just seem to want to hear what you have to say. But anyway, since Daryl is out for the next podcast or two, we thought we'd bring in a ringer and an old friend of the podcast, Ben Pinchback. So thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, baby. It's good to be here. Love talking to you guys. And speaking of TC's trend setting, I mean, yep. I just can't get away from positive player interaction. I mean, you know, since he hit, you know, the scene with that, it's like everywhere. I can't open a game without it. So, I mean, I blame TC.
Dude, I hope that's true. I'm not feeling the love as much as I think I should be feeling. So hopefully that trend continues, picks up some steam here.
Well, I think that we didn't really adhere to that in Fate of the Elder Gods, but a lot of other games are about positive player interaction.
Well, you help people out with the curses.
Well,
you just help them.
You just
like
them.
Here, this is your curse.
Right,
you
you're
go.
Just like,
here's
I'm
the
not,
bad thing, but I'm
not,
giving it to
right.
you. It's fine.
I'm not doing this to you. The game is doing this to you.
I will be honest. I got to give TSC a little credit. When we do things these days, we have been looking for ways to make everybody kind of do the fun thing at once, you know, as much as possible. So TC has rubbed off on us a little. So I'll give him a little credit, you know?
Yeah, that's great. This is great. I love this podcast already.
Oh, you've opened the floodgates, Ben. All right. So as for the topic this time around, we're going to take a deep look at some of the major board gaming trends over the years. We're going to even dig way back to 3500 BC. We're going to get into all that in just a little bit. Let's talk about, has anybody played or done anything notable lately? So, Ben, let's talk to you first since you're our guest.
Yeah, so I played this cool, like, two-year-old Queen game. You know, remember when Queen was on all their games for, like, $10 online, like, 6 months ago? Or... So Matt picked up a bunch of them, and he picked up this game called Ligeria, Ilguria. I think it's like a prequel to Fresco or something. Because it's got this super exciting theme of transporting like paint swatches across with like animal. You know what I mean? Like it's really exciting. You're like transporting paint. You know, like if you're not watching paint dry, you're transporting paint. That's way better. It's but it's like the Euro-y most Euro. But it was really good. It had this little circular mechanism where you had your boat and everybody's got a player area in front of them, and in between us are like little islands, so you move around in the circle and you kind of pick up these paint swatches and bring them back to your own little area. That's kind of how you like do contracts and whatever. But the super Euro-y part that's awesome is you build up your tableau and you can get better in like four areas by collecting these tiles. So like one is your boat moves farther if you get more of the captain wheel tiles. And another one is you can pick up more paint if you get more of these bag tiles. And there's some other ones that are points and some other things. But the awesome like Euro-y thing you do is there's this lineup of tiles. So a four-player game, I don't know, there might have been 15, 16, 18 tiles out or something. And it's like you pick in turn order for you go to these spots that say how many tiles can I pick up, but the more tiles you can pick up are farther down on the turn order slot. So Chris, if you went to the very first slot, like you're gonna pick tiles first, you might only get one tile because you're picking first. But if I chance it and go like way to the end, I might get to pick four or five. So, and then there's a bunch of spots in between where you might pick one or two or three tiles. So it's like this little like knife fight where Chris, if there's a tile you really want bad, you're thinking, well, if I go to the two spot, am I going to pick first or is somebody going to be a jerk and go to the one spot? Or, you know, is Ben going to sandbag it and go to the four because he wants four tiles? And then in addition to the tiles, you also pick these cards. But I don't know if I explained it well, but it's this super Euro-y little decision that's amazing. And then you do like more Euro things and good Queen game. But it kind of depressed me about Euros because there was like this amazing Euro I'd never heard about. And then it's like a 6.9 on BGG with like 100 ratings. No one's ever heard of it.
Yeah.
I've like, heard of it, and I've heard people talk about it, but I've never come across it in the wild. It's just weird.
Like, Matt, yeah. We could have spent 2 years making this game, and then, you know...
You think
it's
this
a
is 6.9 like
6.9 with 100 ratings?
You think this is like your Morocco? Is this Liguria is like Morocco?
I do feel a little Morocco-ish for Alessandro Zucchini or however you say his
name. Zucchini.
So yeah, that's what I played the other day.
And all right.
Yeah, I'm just like feeling like, you know, we're gonna get into trends and everything, but like. There is a definite trend of there's a lot of throwaway games, and they're not like they're bad. It's just that there's a lot of games in between that kind of just get missed lately, right? I'm just so surprised that like I'll see these games that come up on the list on like Board Game Geek, and then they just have like 100 ratings a month later. And I'm like, wait, why didn't anyone buy this game? Everyone was loving this, and it's got like a okay rating, but no, I don't guess there's just. I don't know.
Too many games, I guess. It's crazy. I worry about that.
I guess so.
I worry about that with our releases. I don't know.
Got to be
sounds like a show topic, because I feel like the trend is if you don't stand out with something goofy right now, you just can't throw a dry, awesome Euro out right now like you could 15 years ago. Like you said, there's just too many.
Yeah. And you definitely can't do it on Kickstarter unless it's like, Stefan Feld or something like that. Like people were waiting for Merlin, you know, from Queen at Essen, and that's but that's got Feld's name, so it's got that pedigree behind it. So it's hard, man. It's
and then I attended Grand Cant. That's what I did this weekend.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Did some Grand Cant. You guys are all at Grand Con in downtown Grand Rapids having a blast, and I was kind of stuck home doing the thing, and but. You know, I wrote this huge, ridiculous blog on how to sell games that went pretty well.
Oh, yeah. It was good.
I read that in your voice.
Yeah, like, totally.
That's hilarious.
Your voice in my head.
I totally did the same thing. Voice.
I mean, what you got to do is just become friends with people and sell them games. I mean, I could have saved you 4,000 words.
No, it was totally you, dude. Just the way you write is the same way you talk. I could just hear you saying everything in that article. It was good. It was really good.
Yeah, well, I just saved everybody time. So go to conventions, become friends with publishers, and then you can sell them games. That's kind of the gist of it. So what did you do, Chris? What have you been up to?
Me? Hey, speaking of talking to people, I actually had I went to Grand Con. When you went to Grand Can, I went to Grand Con, and I had a panel. It was how to be a publisher. And sweet. I told everybody, don't. Matt Forbeck was the moderator for that, and Travis Chance and myself was on the thing, and Daryl Andrews was on us as well. And Daryl got in there a little later, and Daryl goes, why am I on this panel? He said, I'm not a publisher. I don't know why I'm on this panel. And he goes in, but it was good because after 30 minutes when he had to convince everybody in the room not to be a publisher, it devolved into how do I pitch my game to publishers because they were all designers. So it was good, and it was basically we said talk to people. Talk to people, get out there, network, get to know people. If you really love logistics and losing a lot of money, then be a publisher. If you want to get your game made, go talk to people and get your game made. Or if you just want to see it in front of people, talk to the game crafter. I mean, we get lots of resources. It was a good panel. It turned into a really good panel at the end. Otherwise, though, Grand Con was awesome because I got to see everybody, including Matt. We played a lot of games while I was there. We played Gang Rush Breakout, which I mentioned a little bit on the last podcast, but again, a completely ridiculous game with this 3D bridge, and you're racing gangsters across it, and you're shooting at each other, and it's like a little mini Thunder Road. It's not meant to be taken 100% seriously. I had a blast. It's the second time that I played it, and I can't wait to show it to more people. I mean, it's a total toy. It's a total toy. I don't care.
Where did that one come from? Who put that one out?
I don't know who the original publisher was, to be honest with you. I had it in my mind not too long ago. But anyway, CMON picked it up and is responsible for its distribution here. And it kind of came out with little fanfare. It was previewed to the Nuremberg Toy Fair. But all of a sudden, it just burst onto the scene and like some review copies were sent around. I actually saw it because Jamie from Secret Cabal had it on his Facebook page. And I was like, I'm buying that. And I bought it right sight unseen. But yeah, it's I had fun with it. Everybody who's played it has had a lot of fun.
What is that bridge thing for that goes up and over like the bridge? Like, what is that used for?
Yeah, I thought you swung the cars when I first saw it. I was like, oh, it's a dexterity thing. You're smashing the cars, but no.
It's totally for looks. It's all,
are you serious?
Yep. It's like all the table presence.
In Colt Express.
Yep. Exactly. Oh, it's just supposed to give you that kind of arched or the bridge look to it. So you look like you're crossing across a bridge. And I mean, it does those supports and like a couple of those supports do make a difference because when you ram cars, you could theoretically ram them off the bridge. And then Lakitu comes along and picks them up and drops them right back on the course. But literally, it's a crane, and I was like, it's a little Lakitu going along, and you have to pay for it.
Oh, holy crap, it's got, like, little papercraft containers and stuff?
Yep. It's all 3D, and you're dropping the containers as you go because you draft, like, hazards that show up on the bridge as you go, like oil slicks and police officers that shoot at you, and the little 3D containers and stuff like that. It's totally a toy, and it is completely ridiculous, and it's not meant to be taken seriously, but I love it. It's so much fun.
Oh my gosh, I feel like I need this one too.
It's got some clunky parts to it, and we've already house ruled like three things, and that's okay. But you know, I expect that. I mean, it's a little bit old school. Let's see. Other than that, at Grand Con, I also played several prototypes. One was Astro Venture from Kellen Freeman, which is about going into space, which is pretty cool. It's kind of an efficiency engine game that we've been following from his for about a year now. I played Jesse Wright and Travis Chance's Diesel Punk Apocalypse, which was another take on Thunder Road, but this one was awesome. So much fun. You're basically it's Mad Max and you're one gang and you're just basically running down the Thunder Road and trying to like blow each other up and knock riders off. And when your thing blows up, you get another one and it comes right back onto the track and it has all new powers. It's a lot of fun. You're playing for more victory points than Thunder Road, because Thunder Road is just an elimination. You don't get eliminated in this. You just keep bringing in new cool cars, and it's your gang just keeps coming and coming and coming. But more about that later. We also got to play Avengers Assemble Battle for New York from Richard Launius, which, as you can imagine, was highly thematic and had lots of dice in it, and it was a blast. We had a lot of, we actually got a lot of good feedback on that, which he incorporated for several other playtests that he had throughout Grand Con. So that was a lot of fun. And it's basically based on the first Avengers movie where tons of the Chitauri are coming in. And it feels like the Avengers too, because you're like laying waste to these huge columns of Chitauri warriors and like just blowing the crap out of them. And everybody has special abilities, like Cap can throw his shield and Iron Man's got his repulsor beams. It's total Launius joint. It's really, really good.
Is he just doing that with the hope of like selling it to Upper Deck or somebody like that?
Yeah, he's talked to several people. I can't talk specifics about it, obviously. But,
sure.
But yeah, okay. He's built it. He always builds these Marvel games because he loves Marvel. But in the hopes that he can do a superhero type adventure for Marvel. And then he talks to the people who have the licenses. And this one, man, somebody should pick this one up because they got the Marvel license. This feels exactly like a Marvel game you'd want to play. It's got little 3D buildings. And now, yeah, after our feedback, he's incorporated how to use the figures on top of the 3D buildings. It's awesome. So we
can you at least try to get the mayor fired?
You possibly can if you blow up too much of the city, probably. Yeah.
That is an inside joke about Shark
Island.
The Shark game that he Shark Island main game right. that he made. Just for the listeners at home.
Speaking of islands, that, go ahead.
I was just going to say that Marvel game with the big 3D buildings sounds like his idea for Ladder 29 that he told Jason Katarski at Unpub. So did Ladder really? 29, our little ladder climbing card game, you know, like a deck of cards, basically. And he said it was pretty good to Jason, but what he would do is get rid of the hot spots and instead put a big plastic 3D building with like plastic kids, you could say. So like basically the same game, but with a huge plastic building and plastic kids you saved from the fire.
I don't know why Jason didn't listen to that. It makes no sense.
Sounds awesome to me.
It sounds like it's in the green couch box too.
So speaking of islands and Shark Island, I've got to play Mike Fitzgerald's Dragon Island, which was...
Oh, sweet. You played that.
I did. I got a chance. R&R, Dan DiLorenzo was there from R&R and was selling it. And Heather Newton, the marketing specialist for Grand Gamers Guild, got it. And I went over to Mark Spector's house, who is the president of Grand Gamers Guild. And we got to play it at his house on Sunday before I left. And it was interesting. I don't know what to make of this game yet. Like... It was weird because there was three players and we all tried different avenues for victory, somewhat unintentionally, but we did three different avenues for victory and we all came within like 2 points of each other, which is good, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's what you want out of a game. But in the middle, it just felt, I don't know, Mark and I were both really frustrated. Like, we weren't doing what we really wanted to do, but we were still getting points. And so we kind of got relegated into the avenue for victory that we were didn't necessarily went for, but we had to kind of default go for. And it's interesting because it has really cool mechanics, but I don't know, it's kind of a mix of new and old school. It's got, you can definitely tell that there's some part of Mike in there because he designs stuff that's really cool, but he's an old school designer too. So you can see some of the old school that's in there where you got to remember certain things that happen versus the new school, which is, you know, grabbing all these resources and trying to wrangle the dragons and then try to capture the dragons and lure the dragons. And, yeah,
I understand what you're saying. Cause I'm looking at a picture on BGG and it shows the player reference sheet behind your screen and it says on your turn there's 8 steps, 3 yeah. optional, 2 conditional and 3 mandatory, and then it goes, I mean it looks a little overwhelming in that respect. I kind of know what you're saying.
Yeah, getting into it, and I wouldn't say it has a steep learning curve, but definitely figuring out like when you can do certain things and can you lure multiple dragons with gold, and I don't know. There's a lot of exceptions. There's a lot of steps, a lot of exceptions. And once you get toward the middle of the game, you kind of get used to it. But at the same time, you're like, this could probably be streamlined a little bit. And Mike's a great designer, obviously. But I think that this is his most complex game that I've ever seen him do. And I think that it's a great design for, I guess, his most complex one. But I wonder how much development went into it. Before it went to press. Not to say it's a bad game at all. The mechanics are solid, and obviously our scores were super, super tight. But I just need to play it a couple more times because it was a very shaky feeling all the way through trying to just feel my way through it. But I'm glad I got to play it. So,
you know, this is going to be a theme, like a multiple for me. Play one. This is a theme for me today, but it kind of looks like for their borders, they did the bucket fill from paint, you know?
Yes. We all...
I didn't even want to bring that up.
Why is everybody doing that these days?
I'm glad you brought that up, though, because we actually had a huge discussion about it when we were playing the game, because it would have been so easy just to sepia tone the whole tile, and you wouldn't need borders or anything. You could easily tell if it was green or red or, you know, whatever. Yeah, those borders, man. Oh,
like, you guys... y'all, professional designers, artists, I've been around for 6 years now, have spoiled me to want, like, textures and gradients and, like, you know, if I can replicate it with the bucket from paint, it can't be in the production copy. That's where I'm at.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I believe this could even, if you had the art assets, you could make this a Ridback proto. So... I believe in
you. I would play it, honestly. I would play it because I love Mike. He's smarter than I'll ever hope to be. And I bet there's like a lot of cleverness under the skin, right? And you kind of said that. And I would like to experience that because I love Mike's games.
Yeah, it was a fun. I'm glad I got a chance to play it. And we had a choice on that night. I bought Whitehall Mystery, which is the streamlined Letters from Whitechapel. And it was between that and Dragon Island. And we were leaning one toward the other, and I was like, well, everybody want to play Dragon Island. I was like, yes, let's do that because we'll have a chance to do that. And I'd already played Letters from Whitechapel. So I haven't had a chance to play Whitehall Mystery yet, but from what everybody's saying, it is like really good. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'll just roll off a couple of them really quickly. Saving Time, which is the new co-op from Richard Launius about saving time. You're basically time agents that have gone through because these aliens are causing ripples in the past, and you got to figure out the alien code sequence that has started to unravel the time stream. And it was a ton of fun. I mean, of course, playing any game with Richard's a ton of fun, so it's excuse my perception a little bit, but obviously I had a good time playing it. People who are fans of co-op and, of course, very thematic games, and of course, Richard, you can pick that up. That's coming out soon. Should be out now by 8th Summit. I did a Fate of the Elder Gods charity play, which was super tight. I wasn't pulling any punches. They asked me to play in the game, and I wasn't pulling any punches. And I almost won, but there was a woman who was playing who was like way behind the rest of us, and she really poured it on. She like started really tweaking at us and moving her summoning track all the way up, and finally she just got to the very end and just killed us. So that was amazing. I played a 7-player game of Viva Java on TC's birthday, so that was awesome.
Yep, it's great.
It was all just for TC. We played Time's Up Total Recall, which of course was absolutely ridiculous. I got a chance to play that with Matt, and let me tell you, Matt may be grumpy, but when he plays something like Time's Up Total Recall, he is all in. It is hilarious. Like, he did, I don't know, there was Titanic was one of our clues at one point, and he had his leg up on the table and his shirt up too, saying, like, you know, rubbing himself, like, draw me like one of your French girls. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? I mean, he was just out of control.
You know what's funny about that game is we've been playing that since, like, the late 90s, you know, back when it was just crazy names in a hat.
Right.
And you'd all just write, I guess it was Celebrity. Most people called it Celebrity. You'd just write, like, everybody would write 10, and then we would just play it. And then, like, 15 years later or 10 years later, it's like, hey, somebody published that game. Oh, man, we should have thought of that. You know,
that's what he was saying. Yeah, Matt was talking about names from a hat, and you're absolutely right. It's totally that game, and it's still... I mean, yeah, we should have all published that game, but it's still one of the best games of all time. And they do a great job because there's so much synergy between all the clues, because we had like 3 clues that could have been interpreted as guitar playing. Like, one was Guitar Hero, one was Deliverance, and one was Born in the USA. And they all had to do with, like, you know, the air guitar look to it, and we all kind of mixed them up. So still a great job of all those things overlapping. And finally, Fake Artist Goes to New York, which is always funny and always a blast to play.
Well, all
right, TC, what have you been up to?
Yeah, well, I not too much in comparison. I did the 7th Mythos Tale thing. I'm 7 out of 8 in, and I guess there's an extra one that I'll do that I might never get to. I'm starting to really think there's a lot of mistakes being made with Mythos Tales. Sadly, I enjoy the overall Cthulhu part and all the like the mythos getting in it, because I don't know all the different people in it, so it's cool to see how they implement them and then teach you as you go about like different mythos creatures and stuff and all the Lovecraft stuff. but I do know some of it, right? And the problem was we played it, and it has a, You know how like you play Sherlock Holmes or something. You go, I think we should go to the crime scene. The crime scene sounds about right. We'll go to the crime scene, and then that'll give you a clue, and you'll be like, ooh, we're going to go here. And it's like, it gives you this hint that you're on the right path. And Mythos Tales sometimes just goes, and this was definitely the case, we had, in order to figure out that we needed to go to this one place, we had an actual clue that said, on this wall, there's a business card, and it has this person's name on it. That person's name is not in the directory. And then and then we go to the next thing, and they're like, the clue is, and we saw that. We're like, well, maybe we should try to look for that. Nobody was there. And so we go to the next place, and they're like, yeah, did you check with that business card? And they still didn't give us the name or anything about it. Twice in this, there was 2 things that did that. And then when we went roundabout and found the thing, they finally were like, oh yeah, it's on the business card. You go to a different spot, and they're like, oh, we looked at the business card, and it has this address on it at a different spot. And and that address took us to people that were unrelated in any way other than just giving, they were like Deus Ex Mac, like, you know, just, it was like a fortune teller. We just went off to them, saw them, and they had nothing to do with the plot. It was just like,
that's not good.
We just went.
That's not good at all. Yeah,
it's like 3 disjointed things all together. And I'm like, I think there was I don't know where the mistake came in. Like, did we miss the? Yeah, I don't know. But wow, it was a mess. And but it's like it's got this cool thing, like there's time, like as opposed to Sherlock Holmes, instead of just feeling like, oh, I don't know how long it took Sherlock Holmes to do this, they like give you a certain time track and they tell you, hey, you have until this time to do it, and you can go over that if you still like, you're like, oh crap, we got to check on this thing. But they mess it up with all these other cool things that just don't work. Ah, so it's such a missed opportunity because it has a better system than Sherlock Holmes. It's just not as good from the storyline part. But anyway, after 7, it sucks because I wanted that last one, but I just don't know. I got to get motivation to do it.
To do it and realize you're going to go on a wild goose chase, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's frustrating.
But you played the first one with me, and it was pretty good. It was just an intro, and it had that one big typo, but
yeah, big. Know, yeah,
it was missing.
How do they do the resolution? So if you figure out the puzzle, how do you check, you know, what's their system to?
Oh, they do the same thing as like Sherlock Holmes. You just do a questionnaire at the end.
Oh, okay.
So they got a bunch of questions, which is kind of, I mean, they could have done something a little bit different, but one of the cool things in this is that, that is missing from like Sherlock Holmes is, you can go to a place and it'll say, hey, take requirement card 3. And you would, and so you're like, oh, sweet, I got the thing I needed to go back to this spot and unlock a new passage. So it's kind of cool. Like, oh man, I just got this new cool knowledge. I'm going to go back to that spot that I saw that I needed that knowledge. And then they give you like a new passage about it. I'm like, that's awesome. But the problem was we had literally 9 of them in this game. And one of them, we checked at the end, one of them had anything to do with the plot. That's real bad. Because those are all red herrings. Every single one of the cool things that you're collecting going, oh, this is cool. Every single one of them was a red herring. Ugh. Anyway, so...
Did you play that Deckscape game yet? The Fate of London Deckscape?
Oh, I did.
Yet?
I did. Yeah. Did I talk about that the last time?
No, not that you played it. But I was going to say, what I love about that game is the puzzles have a freeform answer. So I loved Exit, I think, more than you guys did. But it did boil down to every puzzle is, what's the 3-number code that, you know, the puzzle led you to? And that's not a spoiler. That's just how the game works. The puzzle is something, and then it's going to be 5, 4, 6 or 9, 8, 7 or green, blue. You know, it's just 3 things, color, number, color. You know what I'm saying? I like the Deckscape because it was like, here's a puzzle and just tell me the answer. It could be anything. And then you flip the card over and you were either right or wrong. The thing that was a little bummer about it was when it really boiled down to it, it was just kind of a deck of puzzles and it didn't matter a whole lot. You were keeping track how many you got wrong, but what I would like to see, and I even thought about tinkering with, is that system where you freeform it, but if you're right or wrong, it should send you on a path, right? Like, it shouldn't just be like, oh, you got 4 wrong, you know, your average success. It should be like, puzzle 1, if you get it wrong, you go here. If you get it right, you go there. And there's, you know, if it had freeform answers with divergent paths, I think it would be like super awesome.
I think it would too. I think the only problem people have with like the Exit one is that like you have to throw away half the game. And it's like the only problem with that would be like, oh crap, I could play this again and because I missed some puzzles, but I also got some of them.
Yeah.
So like you'd be like, ugh. But no, I did play Deckscape. Good call. But not this week, like a few weeks ago. I don't even know if I mentioned it on here, but we'll say, yeah. Hey, you, Ben and everybody, did you buy the copy at Gen Con?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I can't remember if I've said anything about it on air, but like we played the Deckscape game. Ben bought it. They played it at Gen Con and seemed to be having an overwhelmingly good time with it. And so we played it with my group, right? And it was, yeah, it was super cool. The cool thing I liked about it was that Exit, you just pretty much have to find the problem and then solve it because you can't go out of order. Once you go out of order, you've ruined the experience, right? So in this one, though, you had like 3 piles. You could choose which one you could go for. And sometimes you should be going for those other ones, right? And so we had 4 people. So 2 people could work on one, 2 people could work on another. And that part, that's part's awesome. That's really good. Hey, it took us a little longer to do it. But at the same time, I felt it was good. And I liked the puzzles. In general, but like you said, yeah, it's like the do you do it where you can make these really cool intricate puzzles that get you just numbers, or do you do it so that you just have like a pile of puzzles? I don't know. I don't think they've figured it out perfectly just yet.
Yeah, without spoilers, I thought Deckscape did a great job of having the puzzles be like creative. When you get into it and you're like, I see what they're doing. Like, we got to think outside the box and like kind of almost like nothing's out of play. And it was really fun for that.
Oh, they love to do the red herring thing too. Then that one for sure. It would just be like, oh, here's a card. And you could just look at it. And if someone was across the room, they'd just be like, why are you guys spending any time on that card? The answer is obvious. And you're just like staring at it going, oh my God, what is it? It's like, there's two things. It's because interjection. We need three cards for this. That's very
all right. This doesn't give anything away. I promise. There's a puzzle where they ask you the password. Okay. Right. They ask you the password.
When Scott Alms.
Listen, when Scott Alms figured out the password and I looked at him and he told me how we knew the password, I almost died. It was like my greatest moment in gaming ever. Like, just for that, I give him all the credit in the world. Like, oh my God. And I got the other one too. I haven't played the time travel one yet. I bought it. I'm waiting for the right group and time. So bravo to DG Jockey or whatever that company is.
You're right. That was absolutely phenomenal. That puzzle was really, really, really funny. So play escape games, do all that, play Sherlock Holmes S games, but most importantly I played Lyngk, I think it's the postquel, the sequel, the prologue, the epilogue, I don't know, to the GIF series. So it's like an extra game he tagged on to the end because he's like, I don't have any creativity, so I have to just throw it in with the rest. And I swear it didn't work because there's no, like, no one is talking about this game. Like, it just got like zero buzz, and it's another one like it's great, but at the same time it's got like 100 ratings on Board Game Geek, and you know, it's like, and all the rest of the games were just well known and had tons of ratings. But Lyngk is cool because it's just like you're just making multicolored stacks of pieces, so you can never it's like a rainbow stack. You can never have two colors of the same type in the stack, and you're just moving them along the lines. But it's got this really cool rule which I've seen in other games, but you claim what color you represent as the game's going on. So no one has a color at the beginning, and there's five colors. And so you pick two, the other person picks two, by the end there's one neutral color and you have two. And if your piece is on the top of the stack, you control it, and whoever has the most five color stacks at the end of the game wins. And it's got this one little rule that's like the gotcha ridiculous checkerboard kind of move. And that's, if you have a certain color, say I have green and I have a stack that has green on top, I can move it by jumping over all the stacks that are green on top. And so because the board is like set up in a hex thing, it just blows wide open how many different crazy things you can do on your turn, because you can just zoom across the board and get in behind somebody. It is really tight and weird, and I think it's one of the weirdest GIF games, and I enjoyed it. So I played it four times in one sitting, and I thought that was fun. So yeah, that's it. And I've just been playing a lot of video games. Sonic the Hedgehog and stuff, and
Sonic
Rocket League.
Where's a Sonic game? I want to play a Sonic game.
Oh, it's Sonic Mania. That's the new hotness.
Really?
It's a 2D one. It's like all the old games mixed together by people who know what they're doing. Like, nobody involved with Sega. So they just mixed them all together and made this really neat game that's like super fast, super awesome, and all the levels are really well designed. So yeah, I don't know. I'm really digging it.
Is that on PS4 or what?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I might have to check that out.
I don't know. If you like Sonic, it is a pretty good Sonic.
Yeah, I never had Genesis, but all of my, like, not all of my friends, but a few of my friends did. It's like, I, of course, was Nintendo boy, so they'd come over and play my Nintendo, and I'd have to go over to their houses to play Sega. But I loved Sonic. All right, well, if that's it for now, let's move on to the meat of the podcast. Since TC was all a tizzy today about the sticker cards in the upcoming Charterstone from Stonemaier Games, which we'll get to here in a few minutes, because I'm sure TC will want to rave all about them.
I'm going to sticker your face.
We thought it might be fun to take a look back at board gaming trends, how they've shaped the hobby, and what some of our favorite games are from those trends. Now, naturally, some of this is going to be incredibly broad, some will be specific, and if you feel we've missed anything, of course, you can just let us know. You know how to get in touch with us, but if you don't, just hang on to the last part of the podcast and we'll let you know. But for now, let's jump in the Wayback Machine and go back to 1933 with a little game called Monopoly. I mean, that's where it all starts.
That sounds like a late start for Monopoly. I thought it was like more of turn of the century.
Well, tell me then, TC, what about turn of the century would be trend setting?
Pit.
Okay, Pit.
Although, right. I will say this, like Pit and like Dutch Blitz and stuff, they were like the first, like, everybody get in and play games as fast as possible.
It's true. It was a real time system.
But I don't know how long that lasted. There wasn't really too many games in that vein. It's just weird that popped up for a few minutes and then went away and then
disappeared.
Never really. Yeah. It kind of just Monopoly took over.
Very, very odd. You're right. It was a turn of the century. Let's do real time crazy stuff. I don't know where that came from. It's very bizarre. But anyway, let's get into Monopoly. So Monopoly, obviously, we're talking about modern gaming. This is where modern gaming came from.
I guess if you call now postmodern, then we're good.
Let's call it contemporary gaming. How's that?
Okay, there you go. That's a good. Okay.
All right. This is when I'm talking about typefaces. When I say modern, that refers to the 18th century. That's not contemporary. So anyway, it's the same thing with board gaming. But anyway, what gaming trend do you honestly think Monopoly ushered in for the next 50 plus years, for better or worse? I mean, obviously, roll and move. We'll just bring that out because it's completely out in the open and obvious. Because every game known to man until like the late 80s and early 90s just about had roll and move in it. I mean, we had Clue, Trivial Pursuit, everything like that.
I'm going to challenge you on that. And
are
I put
you?
This in the notes.
Okay.
What about the Royal Game of India, Parcheesi? How old is
Parcheesi.
That game?
Parcheesi, oh man, that's pretty old. I mean, we might have to go.
That's me.
It's like 700 BC.
We might have to go to board game for that.
If you ask me roll and move from my childhood in rural Ohio at my grandparents' house, it's Parcheesi, man.
It is from 400 AD.
So that's what I'm talking about. All Parcheesi right. set the trend for roll and move, for my money.
All right.
Well, trends were a little longer in that case. I mean, we're talking then, like, you know, 2,000
years
of trend.
Here's the thing, though, Diane. I got this in the notes, but you know it's true. But roll and move... It started all the way back in Senet, which is from the Egyptian times at 3500 BC. And that was rolling four, you know, like triangular sticks that then would move you along a circular track. That was roll and move.
The Royal Game of Ur.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know how accurate
it's
that,
much
that
the
game
same
is.
Thing.
Yeah.
But I've to heard your of- point, I was just saying, Monopoly did do a few things that we're still doing today. You mentioned random decks, community chest, and chance. Those are basically just event decks. And they just don't affect, you know, everybody. They affect a singular player that lands on it. But they're just random event decks. Because it could be you get $45 or pay $900 in taxes, tax assessments, right? I mean, they're completely random, but they're hilarious. We still do that crap today. So that's a great one as far as trend setting.
It's true. We have it in Fate of the Elder Gods, the curse cards. They're basically community chest, I guess.
I was going to say that you have like Monopoly did the whole thing that for like years, people just kept making stock market and money games. Like it was all just about like every single theme. Like we played Power Barons, right?
Yeah.
Every single theme, like during the 70s and earlier than that, was all about just like making tons of money off of weird things, like whatever you were betting
on. Yeah, owning
right?
property or like bidding on stocks or something. Yeah, absolutely.
Generic white business owner was like the theme of every
generic
game
white
ever.
Business owner. Well, even going into the late 70s for Acquire, I mean, it didn't have roll and move, but it had the same theme.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And just stocks.
Yeah.
And I would like to champion my vote for Monopoly setting a trend is minis. and asymmetric player powers.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows the car is better than the iron, is better than the hat. It's just a fact. And the dog, you know what my brother used to do? He used to be the dog, and every time he'd pass me on the board, he'd lift his leg and pee on you.
Yep.
Character.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to do that.
Yeah, they set the trend on that.
You have to make the sound when you're moving the car around. You got to go.
Yeah. Fishtail every corner. Yeah, I mean, come on. They're trendsetters.
I think I will give that to you as far as like setting the trend for minis, because they didn't have to put those in the game. I'm sure they weren't cheap to produce, but yet they gave people a sense of like specialness to the game. I mean, it could have been anything. It could have been little pawns. It could have been anything, but you know, you got the cards, you got money, and then you got these little custom pawns that you move around, which give everybody an identity, and everybody fought over it. Like, I want to be the Scotty. I want to be the car. I want to be the battleship, whatever, you know. Nobody ever wanted to be the iron.
And that continued. I mean, even through Clue, the little minis in Clue are completely pointless, right? I mean, they're just chrome, but
yeah,
they're awesome. That's what you remember about Clue, is the little pipe wrench and
you got
whatever.
A pipe wrench and a revolver, and you got a plastic rope. I mean, yeah, all
this crap
stuff
has been selling games for hundreds of years and is still selling games today.
It is true.
That's the point.
And we're going to get back to the mini revolution here in just a little bit, but you're absolutely right. So we also brought up like games that predate Monopoly for Roll and Move. We talked about Senet. You brought up Pachisi, Backgammon, of course, which is just huge and still played today. So there's still a place for these types of games and places that people like to play them. And I mean, they've lasted for what? 4,000, 5,000 years. It's crazy.
Have you guys played Backgammon?
A long time ago. It's been a while, but I have.
Because everyone says it's good. If I pretended like I had ever played it, everyone goes, oh, if you use the doubler dice, it's a good game. Brr. I'm like, is it a good game, TC?
It's not if you use the doubler dice. I don't know what he's talking about there. The betting part is not the part that, like, oh, this game's worth more. Like, that's not the part that's good, right? Like, the part of backgammon that's good is the fact that, like, it's actually, like, legit. Like, it is fun to play. Yes, if you just roll double sixes the entire game, you win. You just win, right? But at the same time, I was reading an article just recently about this guy that lives by Gilhova, and he's like the international, like, world champion of like backgammon. He lives in like Brooklyn or whatever, right? And I'm like, how is that possible? The game is so random, but there is enough that there is legitimately someone who is at that level and can consistently beat you. Like, I would sit down with him and he would just beat me, like, over and over again in backgammon. So there's got to be something to it. But at the same time, I can't believe that, like, the guy, if he was introduced to other things, he would still be like, yeah, I'm going to go play backgammon. Like, he's not going to. He's going to stop playing backgammon once other things are introduced. But backgammon and this and also chess, that brings in that whole, this was even back when there was Monopoly. If you weren't playing Monopoly, you had two other options. You had abstract chess-like game, so a grid, and you just moved pieces around on it, right? And they were just, like, pretty little pieces. Or abstract card game with numbers on it. Because that is just, like, throughout, like, from all the way up until the 70s, 80s, like, that was the thing. Uno and all that, right? Like, and they're, most of them are outdated at this point, but, like, it was a big thing, and it's still a thing. You'll see Hasbro put out like abstract number card games all the time. It's weird.
It's true.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's because they're awesome. Well, let's move on a little past this whole BC and early AD range, because we've gotten into even more game design since then. We're still obviously playing chess and variations on chess and Go and, you know, anyway. I think the renaissance of gaming started in the 70s through today. But we also saw family gaming had a resurgence. And, of course, this had to do with the fact that people wanted to do something together. They played Monopoly. And, of course, we had Risk that came along. And I'm sure Monopoly caused enough, you know, fights with the families. But we also had a trend in drawing games. And this was pretty much in the late 70s, early 80s. We had Pictionary. We had Win, Lose, or Draw, which became a TV show. And even into Cranium, which happened in the early 90s. So that was a trend that a lot of people tried to emulate, but they could never get past like Pictionary or Win, Lose, or Draw. Cranium brought it in because it was only a a part of that because it tapped into the trivia craze, which again is another trend that was bucked and brought on by Trivial Pursuit. So that kind of defined the late 70s, early 80s to me, was literally sitting down and trying to draw something, even if you couldn't draw, and it was hilarious.
Well, and that was half the fun, was you could be the crappiest drawler in the world and be awesome at Pictionary, because if you were on the same wavelength as your team, stick figures and, you know, the worst drawing ever, if you do it fast enough, you could be really good at Pictionary. Especially, that's like,
exactly right,
me and my brother were like unbeatable growing up, because like no one else in our family was on our stupid wavelength, and we had all these inside jokes and like inappropriate things, you know, that we laughed about. So like we could draw like two lines and know what the other person was talking about, but that's what made that game amazing.
Oh, yeah, we had a game like that, too. My friend Steven and I, we've known each other our entire lives, and we were at camp one time. We were playing Pictionary, and, like, literally he drew two lines, and I said, Abraham Lincoln. And it was Abraham freaking Lincoln. Never, never will I ever guess something that fast. But it was just, it was bizarre. Anyway, that happens in those games.
I feel like the drawing led into the guess the word games. Like you talk like 80s, 90s, like the mid to late 90s for me, we went, and at least in our group, from the drawing games to almost exclusively like these 10 different guess the word games, like Catchphrase and Taboo and 25 Words or Less was our favorite one. That's the one where you actually gamble on, if I have a list of five words to get my team to guess, me and TC are on different teams, and we have to actually sit there and like auction. I can do it in 10 words. I can do it in 9 words. I can do it in 8 words. And you'd be like, okay, TC, try to do 8 words to get your team to guess these 5. And it's amazing. That game is, I'll play it right now. It's so good. But it's kind of funny because like all these games were team games, right? The Pictionary and the Taboo and all that, but like what's the last like super awesome game changing team guess the word game? I mean, they're all pretty old now, aren't they?
Yeah, guess the word. Actually, one that I didn't mention that we actually played at Grand Con was called Crosstalk. And this one was one that I saw being play tested about a year or so ago, but I can't remember who published it, but it's actually like reverse password where you're playing all as a group. You basically draw a word, and there's two team captains, and one team captain is telling a single word clue to the other team, and one team captain is telling the single word clue to the other team. It's like you're reversing password completely, so you want to try to give your team a little bit of a clue when you tell the clue that is to the other team, and so on and so forth. But you got this little other little pad that you circle and say, like, you can make arrangements, like, with what people have said, like what the blue team's clue was versus the red team's clue was and how it relates to it, and little symbols and things like that that you can pass to your team in between. And it was really fascinating. I mean, the Matt was funny. He's like, oh, I can't do a Matt. I wish I could do a Matt. But he's like, The amount of game here versus the fun ratio is not really there, but he's right. It's like, it's a really clever design, but it was taking way too long to play the entire game because we're all debating stuff and passing notes and all this other stuff, and it's all over one word. And I'm like, you know, like you can see Jimmy Fallon, they're playing password in like 30 seconds. And you know, that's kind of the way password's able to play. When you reverse the whole thing, it turns into like a 30-minute affair almost, and you got to be really dedicated to this game. Anyway, it was good. It's not quite as streamlined or as good as the old guessing words, but it was interesting that we played that this weekend.
The game to fun ratio. Yeah, that sounds like something you'd say with a clown.
That's exactly.
You know, it's funny. I just thought of code names. It's like, they took the team guess the word thing. It's like, you know what we haven't had in 20 years? A really good team guess the word game. And it's $1 billion. So we need to revisit some of these ideas, man.
And to be honest with you, though, that it's only been, what, a year or so with Codenames. So we're going to that trend, and we talk about trends that start to cascade, we'll start to see probably more and more of those types of games that are on the coattails of Codename. Because it's a brilliant design. It's a design that hasn't been around for a while, and it reintroduced that type of trend and genre to the board gaming culture, which I think is important.
Let's do Codenames, but with the Taboo buzzer, so you can go and buzz people.
That would be amazing. The Taboo buzzer was the best. I mean, we used to carry that thing with us to do other things. It's just taboo. We just did, yeah, seriously. It was the best buzzer ever. I love word games. So, yeah, I'll play that and Boulder Dash and everything else. So, anyway. All right. So, moving on. When we talk about the mid-80s to late 90s, or mid-90s, when we talk about the family games and the guess the word games and so on and so forth, there was a movement that has had a small resurgence now, but it was a huge trend at the time. This was the dawn of Ameritrash. And this is my playground here, right here. So it's like, it started out with the Milton Bradley Game Master Series, which was Axis and Allies, Shogun of Fortress America. I don't know how many of those three you two have played. TC's no. played two, I
One
think.
One or two.
One or two. Oh, man, you guys, tell you what, I've played all of them. They're awesome. So
I don't like them, but I played it.
But the hallmarks of this Ameritrash movement, but which includes, I will include Fireball Island, Omegavirus, and HeroQuest and all that. Even though HeroQuest was more a British type of thing because it was based on Advanced HeroQuest and the Warhammer series from Games Workshop. But basically, the hallmark of it was a deeper and immersive thematic gaming type of environment with lots of toy factor, you know, minis, you know, it always had to have minis. Or in the case of Fireball Island, you've got an entire sculpted island with these marbles that rolled down, which are fireballs, and the Omega Virus, which is more immersive as far as like the automatic, you know, playing system. All of them had to have a hook, but they also had those miniatures and plastic molded type of things that you didn't normally see, obviously in the family games, something you would see later. Because they're all minis and plastic based kind of stuff, but that's
just plastic everywhere.
Plastic everything. I mean, we loved it. It was
how could we, like, we even look at back at stuff like this? We can't print Mousetrap anymore. Like any company that wants to print Mousetrap as like a hobby game, like no, you don't get to. You just don't. Like, no, sorry, no. Like that's gonna be $120 now. You have to make 3 million copies of it, or else it's gonna be too much to print. I don't know.
Yeah, Mousetrap's an interesting thing too because it's so ingrained into, like, people's consciousness that they reintroduce it to their kids, and then the kids will reintroduce it to their kids. And obviously the only way to do it is mass produce it, because you couldn't do something like Mousetrap for a hobby market. You're right. It's too much plastic. It's nuts. And how it all works together, I mean, that's just crazy.
Well, but that's why I was just going to say, I made this joke on Twitter one day that Rob Davio's entire life has led us to the point where he's bringing Fireball Island back.
It's
like,
true.
To me, yep. His purpose on this planet was to first get the number one game on Board Game Geek, just so he can be the guy to bring Fireball,
to bring Fireball Island back. That's exactly
That's
right.
His hero's journey.
Ever since he announced Restoration Games, that has been the absolute end-all be-all bucket list item that he has received from everybody.
But to TC's point, if me or you wanted to do Fireball Island, even if we could get the licensing for it, like, we don't have the clout. You have to have the clout and, like, be able to print a billion of them to do it at a decent price. And you have to have the hottest designer in the world behind it. Like, everything has converged correctly to bring Fireball Island back, right? Like,
yeah, it's true.
Otherwise, it would have just been impossible.
Yeah, and it was a different time. I mean, obviously, for whatever reason, plastics were cheaper. Mass producing plastics were cheaper. I don't know. I mean, shipping was obviously cheaper because the box that Fireball Island comes in is amazing. It's huge. You could sail on it from Cuba to Florida on the thing. I mean, it's just, it's nuts. And you can't do that anymore. And so, you know, Rob was talking about, like, the logistical challenges they had for Fireball Island. They had to make sure that they could do it in segmented board types. They can't just do it as one flat board, or not flat, but one contiguous board anymore. They got to be able to all fit inside and nest on itself. I mean, there's all these things you have to think about. It's huge logistical challenges that we had and we took for granted in the late 80s, early 90s, which we now can't do for whatever reason. I mean, obviously, because, you know, things were just different then. I love that time. I love the fact that we had those huge big box games that could be shipped everywhere and you didn't care. And it was tons of plastics and minis, and it only cost like $20, and it was amazing. Oh, those times. They're not here anymore.
So when you were playing all these games, because I missed them. I was a little young and, you know, whatever. Had you played like Acquire yet, or the couple, I'll say, early Euro games yet, or did you play those after the fact?
I, okay, so I guess we go back to say the Game Master series. So Axis and Allies and Fortress America kind of hit when I was in late middle school, early high school, probably late middle school. At that point, I had played Dungeons & Dragons in middle school. I had also had some experience with a couple of early type of games from one of my friends, Chris Horner, and I had also, by that time, found Car Wars, which, as we all know, is my favorite game of all time, but it also is one of those that kind of accustomed me to larger rule sets. And so when those Ameritrash games came out, like Axis and Allies and Fortress America, I was able to absorb the rules and be sort of accustomed to what I might get out of it. But I wasn't I was by no means a seasoned gamer who had played like tons of stuff before then. You know, I'd played obviously a ton of games, but nothing as in depth as these. So that was my generation. Yeah,
I think even when I was in fifth grade, I was a Euro gamer and might not have even played these games. I have vivid memories of being in fifth grade and sitting at my friend's house while his dad smoked this huge pipe and the three of us playing a choir. And it blew my mind. It was like the greatest game I'd ever played ever. And then if they would have just like dropped Fortress America on the table next, I think would have been like, can we play a choir?
Well, see, I mean, and it's true. It's like, if you were, I mean, that gives into the Avalon Hill effect. And that's part of a trend setting as well, as far as making those types of games accessible to gamers. Like you go to Hungates. I don't know if you guys had a Hungates, but you remember Hungates, but it was a hobby shop. I mean, that's what we had here in the South that we'd go to and find these types of games at. I saw all the walls of war games, like, you know, Advanced Squad Leader and all that stuff. And then it'd be like Car Wars and the little, you know, plastic pack and all kinds of stuff like that. And then you see the Avalon Hill stuff, and Acquire obviously being one of those, that a certain select group of people saw those and started playing those. And Acquire, you talk about Acquire being a Euro gamer, but Acquire is not a Euro game. It's just it had that kind of system that made you, it kind of primed you for that later trend setting, which we'll get to, about Euro games, that all of a sudden made sense to you.
I think I just want to jump in to like echo what Ben's saying, because we're about to get into the age of CCGs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that the tipping point I would say is any of the games that I played, like HeroQuest and earlier, before I got into the CCGs, I look back now with shame. I look back at them and I go, why was I so dumb to play those games? I know why I was, because they looked awesome and I enjoyed them because they had that awesome, like, oh, look, this game is awesome. Like HeroQuest, I played it once and was like, I don't know about this game, but man, it's so awesome. And when I played like Magic the Gathering, I erased the entire entire history. And then whenever I got into Euros, I erased Magic and all that history before that, because it was just like these things that made me feel better about like the possibilities of games. Oh man, yeah. So I can't imagine playing Acquire as like, if I was 13 and I played Acquire, I'd play nothing else. Nothing else would have mattered. There would be no other games, no video games, nothing. I would play this Acquire over and over and over again, because there wouldn't have been anything else for me to play. I'd be looking around for games that I could play that were like Acquire.
Amen, yeah. Brother.
Yeah, but here's the thing too. That's like that's what's led me down this path too. You've had your path, and you might have, if you said you had encountered Acquire, it might change things. Myself, it wouldn't have changed things for me, because I played the Game Master series and they were deep.
You loved it.
They were deep and I loved them. I mean, HeroQuest was one thing, but to play Axis and Allies.
Poor taste, but it's all
no,
right.
No, not at all, man. Axis and Allies, Shogun, and Fortress America are awesome, and they have great rule sets.
I still have my Axis and Allies moment. The 8-hour game when I'm 9 years old, and I'm playing as, like, America, and I'm waiting 4 hours for my turn. Impossible to play with a 9-year-old. No way. Yeah. Even today, I think about it, and I go, okay, we could have probably got that time way down, but I would still not play the game. No. Nope, veto.
Well, and I guess maybe that's what gave me my patience for that type of game. And I probably, love that probably. Type of game today.
We can get into the age of CCG.
Let's do this now. No, we're going to talk about it now. So this is the next trend that hit, is when Magic the Gathering hit, that changed everything. It changed everything, not just for the trends that were going to be happening in board gaming or card gaming. It changed everything for everybody. Like, everybody all of a sudden realized, what is this? And there's a whole other world out there besides what we're doing. Now, what I will say is that crossover for me is that when Magic came out, I was playing 40K. So I had graduated from the Ameritrash over to the, what we'll call the Euro, I call it Eurotrash nowadays, but we'll call Amero Euro Brit Trash, which is Warhammer 40K. I was playing 40K in college and we were playing it constantly. We lived 40K, but then Magic came out and all of a sudden everybody, no matter you played, people were playing Titan in our local store all the time. They were like, nope, Magic's all there is. They were playing Acquire, they were playing Euro stuff, they were playing 40K, they were playing war games. All of a sudden Magic was all there was for a good 6 months to a year. So the age of the CCG had arrived. Now that is the ultimate shift in trends. So, I mean, I think we were all touched by that. I mean, Ben, you played Magic, right?
All right. So here's the weird story. When did Magic come out? Like 94, right?
About 94, yeah. 94, 95.
So that was right when I was a freshman in high school. If it was now, I would have been all in on Magic. But in 94, it wasn't as easy to be a nerd and an athlete. You almost had to pick. If you're a young listener, it's almost going to be weird sounding and you're going to judge us retroactively. But if you were a freshman in high school in 94, you'll know what I'm talking about. People weren't as accepting of nerd. You couldn't be a cool nerd as easily back then. It's just one of those things. And if you had a mom that thought you were going to go to hell if you played Dungeons and Dragons or whatever, that, you know, was a factor as well.
True.
So
true.
I would have loved to have played Magic. I wish I played Magic, but I kind of missed it. I spent 4 years playing sports and, you know, Risk or whatever we did in high school. And then by college and whatever, I don't know. It's big regret. Never played Magic.
It's interesting that you, like, I think your recollection is probably what most people are going to say. But like, I went to a high school where legitimately, I think, what, 75% of the people were in band, like, of our entire high school, which
so you
means
went to a nerd high school, right?
Yeah, which means, honestly, looking back at that compared to the other numbers, I mean, literally in other schools that have like 5 to 10% of the people are in band, we were part of a school that, like, if we ever went to competitions, we would go out and we would watch other people, and there's like 20 people on the field. We come out and there's like 200 plus. Like, we're this tiny high school that, like, has nobody, but everybody's in band. Anyway,
that's crazy.
So most of the people, if you weren't in band, you were kind of half in band. Like, you were in band and also football. So you had to be on the football field, and then halfway through the year, you'd switch over and become a band member, right? Like, that's how weird it was. So for me, there was no flip over. Like, anyone who was playing track and field, it was in track and field, which I don't know if that counts as sports, but whatever. It kind of does, I guess.
It does. It's in the Olympics. It counts as sports.
Yeah. No. I mean, as in, like, jockey sports, right?
If you can't hit a baseball, it counts, TC.
okay, we'll put it there. All right, but you know, it's like, I played all these sports, right? But I also did all these other things, and never a problem. So we had Magic everywhere, and most of the people who played like track and field, they would have that off to the side. Now, I guess it was more of a gender thing. Like, there was very few women who were playing Magic. It was all guys. And I mean, that's even with, like I said, this is a very nerdy, kind of geeky school with like a ton of band members, and still not very many female players, which is, I think, is weird. And hopefully now it's kind of flipped a bit, but yeah. So my experience has always been that it's kind of like, board games until I got past college were kind of like a boys club kind of thing, which now it's definitely switched. Like, I go to a lot of game nights where it's 50-50, right? And I'm glad that it is too, because it just felt weird to be, it felt weird. I don't know if it felt weird to anybody else, but it felt weird to me.
Did you guys do the same thing basically where it was all Magic for, let's say, like 5 straight years? I mean, Magic all the time.
Not for me, but I think most people did.
It was like 2 to 4 years of just a Magic thing.
Well, I at the time I was so deeply entrenched in 40K that it was half Magic, half 40K. And very little, I mean, we played some other games like Talisman from time to time, things like that, you know, kind of.
Sorry.
Now, to be fair, Talisman is a full bottle of vodka night is what Talisman is. So when we were drinking college, we would get a full bottle of vodka and play Talisman until the wee hours and drink vodka. I mean, that was what you did.
No, it's pretty fun. I love leveling up with those little cones, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, I was pretty much half foot in 40K and half foot in CCG or Magic Gathering. I played tons of other CCGs other than Magic, but Magic was pretty much the predominant one. So, but they were both worlds. Like, you were fully immersed in those different things. And 40K had its own thing, and we won't even talk about all that because it wasn't as widespread as Magic. But yeah, for quite a while there, it was, for me, 40K or Magic. And then that brings us all up until, like, we get to, I guess...
The best movement.
We'll get to, I guess we'll say the late 90s, I think, is kind of where we could start this. And that's the European movement. So that's where the German games started coming in. The European games in general, but the Germans really started it out. You know, the Germany, for whatever reason, loved their board games. And, of course, we all got to play Catan at some point or another. So I think Settlers of Catan, or Catan, or however you want to say it, Settlers of Catan really started that kind of push toward that, which led into Carcassonne and Power Grid and Puerto Rico and all of these really early ones, El Grande, all these really early ones that people started picking up and realizing, like, there's something beyond. They might not be able to find it at Toys R Us, but they had places where they were like, in whispers, hey, have you played this Catan game? What do you think about this Catan game? So yeah, you kind of had this speakeasy movement. Like, people that you might have known were in gaming, all of a sudden we're talking about, hey, have you played this game? This game's awesome. You want to come over and play this game? And you're like, I don't know. Is it illicit? Is it illegal? But no, it's just it's Settlers of Catan. And so through the late 90s, early 2000s to mid 2000s, people were just introducing more and more people to Catan and other European, but mostly German-based board games. That was the huge trend at the time. And that ushered people to... I guess it kind of... For people who weren't involved in the CCG movement, or for me, like the 40K movement, like the miniatures-based wargaming, it was a return to the glory days of, oh, we can all get around and play like Taboo or Cranium or something like that. But it was different. And it was exciting to people because it had something that was very different from their usual gaming circumstances.
So, if I had a time machine, I would use it to go back to the late 90s, early 2000s and catch this movement real time, because I missed it. I had no idea any of this was going on at all. Like, I didn't hear anything about this until like 2004, maybe, when finally someone mercifully showed us Catan. But I can't think of anything better than like being in that scene where you hear stories where like one person knew somebody that was porting over the German games, and like, oh, this one store carries them, and like, oh my god, El Grande is this mysterious game coming, you know, like that whole thing. Oh god, I would have loved to have lived that real time, because this is my golden age. Like, I just want to go back and live in this area of trendsetting. Like, I don't want any of the other stuff, like everything we're doing now. Like, I just want to go back and play Amon-Ra and Ra and Taj Mahal and El Grande and Catan. That's all I want to play. Like, can we just go back to how great that was? Can everybody remember how much fun y'all had? And like, let's just relive the glory days and do the whole Euro invasion again. And I just wish I caught it real time, but I don't know what, you know, what we're doing, which stinks. We're playing poker all those years.
That's what I was going to say. Poker, the
freaking
trend.
Poker ruined it from like the late 90s for however many years. We'd get together and play like $5 poker tournaments all night. And that was what we did. And yep, it was great, but wasn't Taj Mahal. I mean,
no, it wasn't. I was playing. I mean, at that time I had lost Well, I had moved to DC and I'd lost touch with my 40K group, and I was still painting miniatures and still doing some competitions and things like that for 40K. I didn't have anybody around that played Magic. Every now and then we'd have like a board game night where we played something that everybody knew how to play. But I lost a little bit of touch during that time. But, you know, when I moved back to Florida, I started getting back into it because Florida was kind of a hot spot for it. And I guess, you know, during that time, I saw it happening. Like, I remember going into a game store, and seeing Chrononauts there. And this is back, I mean, it must have been 2003, 2004. But it was like, you know, one of those learning stores, and they have all kinds of different things. But I saw like Chrononauts sitting there, and I'm like, it's a time travel card game? I want this game. So I bought it. And then I taught it to a bunch of people at work, and like we played it all the time. And I didn't realize there was more out there until somebody mentioned Catan, you know? And I'm like, well, of course, this is like, and when we played, it was like, duh, this is an extension of what I was doing the early part of my life, but better. I mean, well, not better, but just different. I mean, TC will say better. You'll
it's
say better.
Better totally no, better.
Whatever, it's different.
I was waiting for my chance to talk there so I could make you feel bad about your early decisions in life.
Yeah, I figured. That's okay.
No, I this goes back to me like assuming that every game has existed forever. Like whenever when I first played Catan, I was like, "Oh man." And I just assumed I had missed it and it had been around since like 1910 or something, you know, just like Puerto Rico, too. I was like, oh, well, Puerto Rico's it had to have been around for like 20 years. And like Trivial Pursuit, I was like, oh, well, Trivial Pursuit's always been around. Trivia games have always been there. But no, they're like every single time I play them, they'd come out a few years beforehand. And I just assume they're always there. I just want like I feel too in the hobby now. It's like I it, maybe not the same way as Ben. Like, I like the new stuff that's coming out, but like, I feel like I want some of that magic of like, wow, these games have always existed kind of back in my life, but like, it's never going to happen now. Now I'm like a board game historian. It's ridiculous.
So where were you, TC, during this time? Were you catching these real time or were you a little behind the curve like me?
No, I was just like you. I was playing poker, Texas Hold'em, and we were like, We were getting to the point where we're playing $20 now, you know, as opposed to, yeah. You know, and like, it, like 2 years then after that, like, you know, friends were either playing board games or poker for like $300, you know, it's like, it wasn't like, it was just a weird time. So yeah, it switched on for me. And then after that, I was like, oh, poker, I can put that on the side. I still like poker, but I can put that on the side and play these other games. It was good. But yeah, I 2004-ish really started noticing when things were happening. So like for me, like I said, like Puerto Rico, I think Agricola was the first time I was like, oh, here's a new game. I know it's new. It just came out. Like, that's the first time I ever recognized that. And I had an actual game group at that point, and I could go and play games, and it was weird.
See, we were so siloed. When you talk about a movement and a trend, when we finally hit Catan in like 2004, 2005, we didn't join the hobby, quote unquote. We literally played Catan for almost 3 straight years. Like, we were complete addicts. It like changed my life. Like, all I wanted to do was play Catan. Buying a new game was getting Cities and Knights or Seafarers or that stupid Traders and Barbarians. Like, getting a new game was just getting more Catan, because that's all we wanted to do is play Catan. Like, it was literally a game changer for us. And then thankfully somebody at work, a friend, was like, you know, there's like a billion other of these games out there that might even be better. I was like, what? You gotta be kidding me. like the first two after Catan were like Agricola and Puerto Rico, and I was just like, oh my god, my life's changed, you know, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, my path was slightly different in the fact that obviously I bought Chrononauts. I knew that Catan was out there, but I really got into Pirates of the Caribbean when it came out, or Pirates of the Spanish Main, rather, which was the constructible kind of ship game from WizKids. And that kind of got me back into the hobby and sent me to Dragon Con 2006, which introduced me to a lot of other games that I knew were kind of out there, which eventually led me back to a game that I had played back in 1988 and through college, actually, from someone who had that. And that was a game called Arkham Horror. So when it was released, I was like, holy crap, a new version of Arkham Horror. I'm getting this. And that kind of slipstreamed me into the modern gaming age. I'd played Catan, I played several other games, but that was the one. But it also bridged the gap between my early experience with Ameritrash and thematic games into modern, learning about co-op games, and especially since I'd played, you know, Arkham Horror as a co-op, and that was way back in the day. Now it was kind of fashionable. All of a sudden, that was available. Pandemic was around. It kind of came out soon after that. So it was the golden age, and it ushered in more Euro-friendly content. Now, obviously, I was playing some Ameritrash and very thematic games like Arkham Horror, but we get into now where the Euro games have taken hold. We're all used to them. They get into even more specifics, and not just the German or Euro-based mechanics of things, which were some things that started to be trendy. One of the first things I had on the list here was worker placement. Everybody kind of got used to worker placement. You know, Stone Age ushered that in. There were others besides Stone Age, but Stone Age was the big one. That was the first one that you really got used to, like, taking little meeples and placing them somewhere to do things.
Yeah. Kalos!
Oh, Kalos. Yeah, Kalos. Obviously, Caesar. But yeah.
As much as I hate to admit it, Stone Age undoubtedly was carried the mail for worker placement for more gamers than almost probably. I would actually probably say Agricola if I had to choose one that I think influenced the most. But those are probably the two heaviest hitters for me. Yeah. For my money, it would be Stone Age and Agricola.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Stone Age is kind of the grandpappy of worker placement games. It just is. Most people are introduced to the hobby, especially back in the day, but even now with playing Stone Age. It's just what people know. We kind of progressed beyond that. There were a lot of other kind of mechanics that we hadn't experienced that were being thrown our way. Rondels. I mean, the day of the rondel was like... I'd like to know what the first game with the rondel really was, but Feld kind of made it his own. Especially with Macau.
You just still haven't played the one that started the whole rondel thing. It might just be an imperialized
Imperial.
Game. Oh, Imperial. Yeah, I have not played Imperial. You're correct.
I don't even know if this is a trend, but I still think it's funny that you put it as a trend.
It's a trend. It's a total trend. Everybody was like, we got to put rondels in our games. Let's do this.
There's going to be more. It's still alive.
There's still more rondels coming. I mean, I'm not saying that some of these trends are still going nowadays, because obviously we'll talk about like the lasting impression of these things. But rondels, when the first rondels started coming out, people were like, their minds were blown.
You gotta mention Matt Gertz if you're going to talk about rondels. He's the master. Navigador. He didn't do Imperial, right? It was an Imperial.
Yep, that's him.
Was he Imperial? Oh, it was. No way. Okay. All right. Right on. Navigador. Yeah. Is great too.
Yep. And then deck building, I think, is your first. That's fantastic pick.
Well,
that's a huge shift. It's another almost CCG like shift.
Oh yeah.
Not huge. That big, but like still.
Well,
huge.
I think. Well, the only reason why deck building exists is because of CCGs, but. I mean, it's the whole act of building your deck to make it powerful. That was the fun part of meeting together for a Magic the Gathering night. Well, you might have built a deck beforehand, but otherwise you're sitting there and you're leafing through your loose leaf binder and you're pulling cards out and you're like, I'll make this deck and let's see how it goes. And it's the same thing. That was kind of the fun that was built around deck building. And Donald X kind of came up with that and realized that was what he enjoyed. And so did so many other people.
I was just going to say, that's how I got Matt to buy it, is we were still playing our 5 euros Power Grid, you know, Catan, Puerto Rico, whatever. Anyway, I told him, hey, man, there's this game that everyone says is like Magic in a Box. You should buy it. And that was like how a lot of us, even a lot of us that missed Magic, were like, oh, yeah, I missed Magic. Well, hey, if it's in a box, I should get the experience. You know, we should get this box. It's Magic in a Box.
Yep. And that was, they were off to the races. And it's a trend that still exists today, but it was a trend that really took off and had that lightning in a bottle that Magic had. Obviously, because it taps into something that we love. Whatever it is, no matter what kind of gamer you are, playing Magic tapped into something that we wanted and that we loved. Deck building is the same thing. Whether you like it wholly in your games or you're burnt out of it and tired of it, it still taps into something that it's that unknown. It's like building something that it builds on itself. You got combos. You got something that makes you feel smart when you bring it out, you know?
It's all those things. You nailed it. People like to build things. They like to build something that works, and that's the best feeling, is trying something a little goofy, and then when it works, you're like, I'm the smartest man alive.
Right.
I have a deck of 10 markets, and it works, you suckers. You know, like...
It's back in the old days. That's a good feeling. I mean, yeah, like, I didn't read this before I built it, but I built a Plague Rat deck, and I was like, this thing works, it's amazing, because it's like, you just see it, you know, and you play it, and it's awesome, but yeah, it's... Yeah, deck building, and of course, the legacy of that from the influence and the trends are still being felt today. There are still games that come out that have pseudo deck building elements in them, and people are so accustomed to it now that it's super easy for them to get into it. So
I like the pseudo deck building. Sorry to butt in again, but the pseudo deck building is totally where I'm at now. Like Rococo and the Fister in Africa, Mombasa.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally dig it as an element of, like, you know, a bigger game.
Well, and it also exists in such a way that, like, it doesn't have to be deck building. We've got into bag building with Orleon and Automobiles. We've got...
And the original bag builder.
Yeah, and the original Viva Java.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, we don't even mention that because it's just everybody should just.
I just wanted to. I just wanted to say that trend was started by a certain game.
It's that's true. It is very true. Well, I mean, we just assumed everybody knew that. I mean,
yeah.
We've got the original bag builder and the original Roll and Write.
Can we go with the Roll and Write one now?
Sure.
Because I mean, so Viva Java Dice started the trend of the Roll and Write.
Oh, did that come out before Through the Ages? Roll through the ages.
I don't remember that game.
Wait, was that before Yahtzee? I don't remember that.
It was a one-off.
Or Yahtzee.
That was a weird Yahtzee. Roll game.
What's that? I don't even know what that is. Well, let me tell you.
Yahtzee? 30 seconds. Yahtzee, the one with the 5-gallon bucket and the dice out at the lawn. It takes like 2 hours. It's horrible.
Oh, my God. What is that?
Nobody's paying attention at the barbecue, and you're trying to play this Yahtzee with a 5-gallon bucket with huge dice, and some poor sucker's trying to keep score and round up everybody. Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. That sounds horrible.
You don't want to play Yahtzee for 2 hours. It's terrible. So anyway, you were saying.
No, I'm just simply saying it's like, you know, I mean, before Viva Java the Dice Game, nobody's really paying attention to Roll and Write stuff.
No, I will say this, though. When Viva Java the Dice Game came out, there was a stigma against paper and pencil. There just was.
There was.
Like, if there was a game, if it had a pencil and it had a piece of paper, you shouldn't be playing it. And it just so happened that, like, right after that, there was a string of Roll and Write games, and now it's just kind of an accepted thing. Oh, yeah, cool. There's this whole trend of, like, dice games that you write things on pieces of paper, and it's no longer like, oh, we have to play an old school Yahtzee style game.
And lame. I will say that we fought the good fight when it came to that too, because I did not want Dry Erase. I was dead set against it. We all debated it on the Kickstarter campaign. No.
Whatever. I eliminated mine the second I got it.
You're crazy.
But like, haven't RPGers, another thing I missed out, haven't RPGers been doing Roll and Write nonstop since D&D started? I mean, they must think, oh, like, pat us on the head.
Yeah,
you guys
exactly.
are cute with your Roll and Write.
You guys are so cute.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
They never stopped, right?
No. Well, they just got, like, special pencils and, you know, treated paper and all kinds of stuff. I mean, that's what they're all about.
It still feels old school, though. Like, it still felt like, if you're playing, like, D&D... you're like, oh, well, I'm a Euro player. I don't play D&D. And so, like, writing a piece of paper felt like, oh, that's lowly. I don't do serviceable things.
Go ahead.
No, it just it baffles me, too. And this is, we're a little more on tangent, a little off the rails here, but it baffles me that we got such pushback when we did Viva Java the Dice Game for people who were like, pencil and paper? What are you doing? Because it's like the whole point of board gaming is tactility. Like, you like, I mean, it's so much old schoolness that goes into it. Like, you got the cards and the cubes, and people even gripe about the size of a meeple. And all of a sudden, you're griping the fact that you've got to use a pencil and a piece of paper. I mean, that's like going back to, like, living in caves almost. I mean, it's like it's built into you. Like, write on a piece of paper with a pencil. It's like, I don't get it. Anyway.
Well, from a designer standpoint, most of the components in a game are just for accounting purposes. Like, where is my influence? How much have I accumulated of something? So imagine a system where you can track endless data on like a small piece of paper. And then you telling designers now that that's okay. You're going to give me a spreadsheet and you're okay with it? Are you freaking kidding me? That's why we all want to make these things, because now we have endless accounting. I can do like 30 things on this little sheet, just because all I've ever wanted to do the whole time is just write it down, and I've been having to move a cube around the edge of the board instead. Like, you, it's finally, we're home.
I'll be totally honest. Like, these things are totally meant for Matt and Ben, because that is exactly what their prototypes are like. Let's figure out how these.
Oh yeah, my God, do tokens and stuff.
We don't have to like have 18 different sliding scales with cubes going across different ways. We can write it down now. Yeah. Like, it is pretty fun.
Exact thoughts.
Yeah. All right, so let's get on to the last one that I had in here into our Euro friendly territory, which brings us up almost to the modern age, which we'll talk about in a second. But card modification. So we've had it somewhat in the past as far as like playing things that could be thrown off that can modify other things that you play. But Mystic Veil kind of, I mean, we're talking about the clear cards. Mystic Veil was one that brought in sort of the card modification of sliding into and creating a card crafting system that was different than deck building. And, you know, Gloom had a bit of that with the transparent cards, but it didn't really carry it beyond the storytelling element. But Mystic Veil reintroduced that. With sleeves, with the transparent cards. We're starting to see that with other systems. Edge of Darkness, which is the big game system that Mystic Veil used to be before they pared it down to Mystic Veil to introduce them to the card crafting system. Custom Heroes builds on that as well. But that brings us into other card crafting things, which I think that touches a little bit on the next curve, which I think TC was really excited about, was Charterstone sticker cards. So, would you like to elaborate on why you had a kitten today?
I just liked it. I thought I was like, I was blown away. Like, when I saw him do it, it's just, no, it's like, you're watching this video, and like, I didn't know Charterstone's coming out anytime recently. I was like, oh, it's probably going to come out at the end of the year, which is true. It's coming out like December or something, right? And so, he just like, Rodney's like, oh, hello, I am Rodney, and I am going to be the nice Canadian guy for now. Let's play this game. And he just pulls out, he's like, and then you pull the first card. And what you do, and then you take the tile off the card. And I'm like, brain just everywhere, right? Because that's not how things work, right? He just, and it's so easily just like pulled this little hexagon tile right off the, like, you know, sticker right off the card. And then he could put it back in a stack of cards, and it didn't affect anything. It wasn't a different size card. It was the same. Every card was the same. Just some were cut specifically to have stickers that could pull out of that card. And my mind was blown, because the possibilities that you have with that I didn't even know existed. Like, as a designer, I'm looking at it like, that's insane. And then I don't care. I just want to sticker everything now, because half the time, half the time when you have like a thing that you put on the board and like you're thinking about, oh, how do I do a legacy thing? Well, that just solved like five different problems that legacy games have. Like, you have a deck of cards and you're going to have to alter it. Well, now you can just take things off of that card to alter it, and you put those things somewhere else. It's so great. It's immediately like just makes me go, brah, yes, I love games. So it's probably super expensive to do this and not feasible for everybody. But wow, is it a good example of what like new technology could do for games, right? And so now I'm like thinking, because as much as it works that way, like, I like it because it's a gimmick, but it's also like fully functional, right? Like, you pull it off, now it changes the card and it's something else, right? But yeah, so good. I don't know. It just it makes me think, what other things can I do that would be like a total gimmick that I could implement into my game, and now it just kind of changes what everybody can do. Yeah, I don't know. So, totally cool. Hopefully the game works good. It looks really simple, but like the car, that part was so awesome.
It's a hook.
Stickers are awesome.
Yeah, dude,
I love stickers. You just have to see it. If you haven't seen it, watch this watch it played video, because it's weird. I don't know. I don't know why I'm so into the sticker, but it was mind blowing. It was awesome. It looks so good.
I've been telling Matt for 6 weeks that people love stickers.
They do.
every time we talk about the Wasteland Express delivery service expansion, God willing, that people will want, I keep telling them, dude, people want a sticker crap. It don't matter if we have to, or because he goes, well, I mean, we could do it a different way. It doesn't really have to be stickers. I'm like, you're missing the point. You're missing the point. It doesn't have to be stickers. People want to sticker
people
stuff.
People love like, stickering stuff. Except they don't halfway. Like they don't like stickering components when it comes out of the box. No.
Stickering.
You don't do that.
No. Actively.
Right. During the game.
Like, oh, look, my little piece, it's now like got a little circle on it, like that has a face. Oh, man, I just added a person. I have a real person on my piece. Like, right. That's so cool.
Yeah.
If it happens during the game, if I'm putting it on before the game, you're like, oh, that's lame.
So that's the whole point, though, is from now on, if I have to have components that need to be stickered, I'm just going to make them part of gameplay.
So exactly, like, the first game. Yeah.
Exactly. First game is like,
you roll
okay.
the blank dice and you add
Yeah, exactly. We're just going to gamify. We're going to gamify stickering the components, and that's it's going to be
chicken
it.
Chicken if you don't.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, that's so funny.
We're stickering everything.
It just made words. Me think, now I can make a tile. Like, you can make tiles. And you could just have a sticker that just covers the whole thing that's, like, transparent, and now it changes the tile. Like, you can do those things now, and it's apparently not fiscally impossible, which is just...
Not fiscally impossible, thinking, just fiscally improbable.
Yeah, but now I'm just thinking, like,
but you can do
yeah.
it. Yeah, absolutely.
I really make transparent stickers that do cool things, right? Like, oh, yeah. Lots of options.
And that's cool. That's where we're kind of moving toward is I think the cards that we've had in the past. So we have multiple use cards that you play for different things, like, you know, Bruges and games like that. But now we have cards that can act and actually have things that you can interact with the games themselves. So card modification, I think, is the big trend right now, is like taking cards and making them do things they didn't normally do, whether it's sliding into things to be translucent to add things to other games or other venues like Mystic Veil and Edge of Darkness, or like with Charterstone, cards that actually have pieces that can come off and be part of the games themselves. I think that is, we're trying to push things more toward just cards doing more than just we expected. I've got a couple of ideas actually that we've tested that I've played around with that I'd like to do for Sleepy Hollow that do a couple things that are different.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's
sticker
like
cards.
Not sticker cards, but cards that are just pushing the boundaries of board gaming, you know, the storytelling aspects of things. So we always want to try to do something a little bit different. And I think that's a great trend. We're always trying to take the immersion level of the game and the layers of the game further, which is what I love. And I love playing games like that. So we're going to be wrapping up soon, but there's a couple of different trends that have come up recently that we'd be remiss if we did not mention. And one, of course, is the return of the mini. Naturally, me growing up being an Ameritrash gamer with everything had minis in it. We had Axis and Allies, we had Fortress America, we had HeroQuest, all these different things. Playing 40K, I love my minis. But today, the trend for miniatures is out of control because everything on Kickstarter that's on a small game has to be large and has lots of minis in it. And that it kind of was ushered in by Cool Mini or Not and also Kingdom Death Monster and a few other large Kickstarter projects like Cthulhu Wars and things that have now made tons and tons and tons of money simply because they have miniatures in it. And yet, a lot of people buy them and are not sure if there actually is a game in there. They just want the minis for them.
You know, I got a perfect game now. After all this talk, they should just include paint in the box, and you have to paint your mini actively while you're playing.
Yes,
part of the game.
Part of the mechanics. That's right. It's part of the game.
So there you go. So now it's not deck building anymore. Now it's the new mechanic of mini painting.
Mini building. It's paint.
Mini building.
Mini paint building, yes. Every time you accomplish a new thing, you got to paint a new section. It could actually help you paint a lot of minis in the long run.
Seriously.
I think you're on something. But, I mean, that's definitely influenced our culture nowadays. We've seen it in the past 2 to 3 years on Kickstarter. We see it constantly. And more have shown that they have this disposable income and love for miniatures that, obviously... when I was and the 40K culture, it's tough to swallow because people used to gripe at Games Workshop because of their raising prices and their different practices and trying to stay in business. But yet they kept pushing the envelope as far as what better and better miniatures could be, especially plastic miniatures. And all that has built toward the trend nowadays of, I want minis. I want this mini, and I want it to be custom, and I want it to be, highly detailed and all these awesome things. And all that came through the growing pains of Games Workshop having to do that and having people gripe about it. And they still gripe about it, but yet they'll pay, $400 to $500 for a Kingdom Death Monster stuff, which is kind of mind-boggling, but it's out there. The money's out there, and people love to pay it.
See, my personal goal in life right now is to use this current phenomenon to get us back to where we should have never left, and that's like 2001, with minis. So me and Matt are just trying to run the Eric Lang playbook, which is make a good Euro with minis. And it's totally working. I don't want to say Fate is a good Euro with minis, but some might say Fate is a really good
Euro with minis.
Minis. It's true. And people are slowly getting on board. And before they know it, we're going to be back to where we should have been, in that beautiful place. Plus minis, and I think everybody can be happy.
Yeah, I think you're right. It tickles my Ameritrash sensibilities, and it satisfies my Euro loving sensibilities as well. So that would be awesome.
But for real, I think the hybrid has a big, I don't want to say that's the next craze, because I think it's just a subset of the minis craze, but I think a lot of us do appreciate a hybrid, and I think Wasteland Express has proven that there's a big market for a hybrid. Like, most people bought that game because of the art and the game trays and the minis, but it's been reviewed well because people like the game. They like the decisions, and they like the Euro-ness, frankly. A lot of people don't. I mean, some people say it's a two because you don't attack each other, whatever, but the majority of people have said, we really like, the simple. They don't say they like it because it's a Euro, because maybe they've never even played a Euro. A lot of gamers are only been in the hobby a year or two. They haven't played Raw and stuff. So these gamers that buy Wasteland, they don't know that they're appreciating a Euro. They just know that they got a art they like with cool minis and game trays. And then, oh my God, there's actually a good game here that made me think and like plan around a solution type of thing. So I'm going to keep pushing for the hybrid because that can scratch my itch.
And I almost included hybrid in the notes because, Wasteland is one of those things, like you mentioned, Fate. I mean, we've skirted that line as well, given good Euro gameplay with minis and things. And Scythe, of course, coming before that.
Scythe. Big one.
Yeah. So those are all leading that kind of hybrid movement. And even back in the early days of Dice Hate Me Games, we tried to have that Euro sensibility with the Americana aesthetics, not necessarily minis, but bringing the European and widespread appeal of those types of games to very approachable themes that were more said Americana, like Viva Chavin and the Great Hall and Holland Company and things like that. So that type of hybrid is becoming more and more commonplace, which I love. That's our wheelhouse, and I think you're absolutely right. That's our trend now, is that we're going to start introducing things more and more to that place. I mean, Legends of Sleepy Hollow does the same thing too. I mean, we've got some video game Euro sensibilities and Ameritrash sensibilities and storytelling sensibility all in that game to introduce more and more people to the things that they love, So we'll keep pushing it. The last thing I'll mention really quickly before we're about to wrap up, but the Legacy Revolution, of course, is one that we have to mention. Pandemic Legacy is huge. Seafall, Charterstone, of course, we just mentioned, but I think we're obviously only seeing the tip of the iceberg as far as legacy type of games will be coming out. We've got two or three announced in the next year. That's just inevitable. I don't know if it's going to be as big as deck building, because it's not as easy to implement. It takes a lot more time to develop. It takes a lot more time to push, and obviously it takes a lot more time for people to kind of get into the game themselves and learn about the game and be immersed in the game.
Charterstone will be interesting because, I mean, Seafall was what it was, but we haven't had a runaway success ground up legacy game yet. I'd consider Risk, Legacy, Pandemic, Legacy, both runaway successes, massive hits, etc. But they were built on existing platforms,
right.
And then Seafall was kind of, you know, people loved it, people didn't love it. I'd say it had mixed results. Nobody has nailed the ground up Legacy yet, because frankly, you listen to the podcast he's on, it takes years to do, you know, something like this. So that's to your point. That's why it's hard for this to be like the biggest fad, like deck building, because it's just too much of an investment to make one of these things. You can't just crank one out, you know. You're talking years.
I was thinking about like how, you know, my spreadsheet foo is getting better because I can start doing these things. Like, I can start actually thinking about it. But that takes like, but you guys could probably even think about it as well. Like, for Legacy goes from the ground up, it would just. It's one of those things. It's like it takes years to even get to the point where you can make a game, let alone try to make a like Legacy version out of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
So jumping into a Legacy is just huge, and the amount of like weird stuff you have to keep track of. Yeah, spreadsheet foo.
I asked the question of what's next, and I don't know who put this in the notes, but it's so true. If I knew, I'd be rich. It had to be Ben. Was it Ben?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, we don't really know what the pulse is in next. We mentioned some that are on the cusp of it.
Japanese CCGs.
Yes. As far as TC is concerned, absolutely. Yeah. I think that
dice and card games, as much as the Carnival, you know, was the original
Carnival
dice and card game.
That's right. all I'm saying is if you want to know the trends that are coming, you just need to look no further than Dice Hate Me Games. That's all I'm saying.
No, but I see, honestly, truthfully, with Ashes. With Ashes and some other games are doing that. I think you're going to see a lot more games that like, Destiny. You're going to see even more games that use dice and cards in a sort of collectible or LCG kind of way. I think that's going to be the trend coming up, because now we've finally figured out that like, hey, you shouldn't probably use dice all the time just to roll and get a random result. You can use it for other things. There's other mitigation aspects to dice.
Right.
So
I think a big fad, I don't think it's the next fad. I think we're in the middle of it, is interesting uses of paper craft. Mm-hmm. And I think there's still a lot of meat on the bone there. Frickin' Camel Up was the one that I would say started it. You looked at that pyramid and you're like, oh my God, I can do anything with chipboard. They did this pyramid that drops dice. And then really Colt Express took it to the next level. Yeah. I mean, that was like blowing everybody's mind. Like, oh my God, this cardboard train. And then Scott Alms figured out he could make a roller coaster and a loop-de-loop out of paper craft. Like,
yeah, Coaster Park
we're
is
in the
insane.
Middle of it. I mean,
oh yeah,
exactly. That's another one that it's not coming, it's already here. I'm really interested to see what other people do with interesting paper craft, because that's cheap. I mean, a couple sheets of chipboard, you know, cut in an interesting shapes, there's millions of things you could do with that. Like little beehives and stuff I was telling TC about, but just haven't figured that one out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. We're starting to see the dawning of things being more immersive and kind of having that toy factor of...
Toy factor. That's almost a big heading. You nailed it. It's toy factor.
It is. I think that's the next big trend. It really is. I mean, it harkens back to the 80s and 90s when we had that toy factor. We've tried to figure out a way we could do it with plastics. We can't do it. Now we're doing it with paper craft or doing punch board. More and more things have to have that table presence. I mentioned it with Gangrush Breakout. There are more and more people who are seeing that you need to have something cool on the table, grab people's attention, and have fun with it. And I just had an idea for a merry-go-round game in my mind where everything spins around and it's a little carousel. I'm going to do it. I'll do it right now.
Bring back the spinner. Right, spinner.
Bring it back the spinner. The spinner. The spinner is the carousel. There's your toy factor.
So should we work on that after the podcast?
Or, yeah, let's do that.
I'll be at work till 7:30 tomorrow.
Let's do it. All right.
Great idea.
Well, we're gonna work on that after the podcast, but for now we're gonna move on to the backside of the podcast. All right, really quickly before we get into notable Kickstarters, I'd like to mention that I was on Botchcast with Craig Morrison and Edward Uhler, where we talk about journalism ethics in regard to paid reviews and general board game media. That has caused quite the kerfuffle, more than I expected it to. There's a huge thread on BGG that I just had to respond to, and people have taken it way out of context. But please listen to the podcast. All we really talk about in the bottom line is transparency. You can go listen to it at botchgames.wordpress.com or on punchboardmedia.com. It's a good listen, and we try to be very even-handed in what we talk about. Other than that, let's go move on to notable Kickstarters. If there's anything you guys want to chime in about, please go right ahead. But I wanted to make sure first off that Spy Club was launched today by Foxtrot Games, our buddy Randy Hoyt at Foxtrot Games. This is a co-op game of kids trying to solve mysteries like Encyclopedia Brown and, of course, Stranger Things and things like that. A little bit less horror-based. There's different campaigns that come in the box. Lots of different cool sort of kid-based, kids-on-bikes-based adventures that seem kind of nice. And a very simple, as usual, Foxtrot Games pledging structure. So you got $39 to get you the copy. $75 gets you two copies, and $140 gets you the Super Sleuth, which is like stuff delivered early. You get prototype copies, so only three levels. Go and check it out. You can get the base game for $39. And free shipping to the U.S. and U.K. Wow. Free shipping to the U.K.? How'd they do that? All right. Networks Executives from Gilhova, the expansion for the networks, only $29. Go and check that out if you like the networks, which we all do because that's fun. Go and back that on Kickstarter now. 9 days to go. It's got $98,000 so far. That's awesome. Everything that we
Networks is awesome.
Yeah, Networks is a lot of fun. I'm going to let TC talk about Legends of Korra.
I have to talk about Legend of Korra?
Yeah, please.
I don't know. We had a little conversation beforehand about it, but I at least know that it is, you know, it's based off of the sequel to Avatar: The Airbender.
Sure.
With the main character Korra. I don't
sure,
know.
Great.
I looked at this beforehand because I was like, well, how would they adapt something like this to a board game? And I my opinion is that they picked a weird thing to do with it, and it kind of looks okay. But maybe they should have done something else that would have got people into Legend of Korra a little bit easier. But I guess if you like an arena battle game about pro bending, I guess that's part of the Korra series. But it's kind of like I'll go back just real quick. Like Bloodborne, I love the game Bloodborne, but when they made the card game, they make it about like the worst part of the game. And I feel like this is another one that's like that. It's kind of like, this is not the real thing that people want to play. They want to play as like airbenders that do cool things, but not in this way. But anyway, if you want to back a game about Legend of Korra because you're really into the anime, maybe this is something that you'll just hit the button for no matter what I say. So that's good.
I mean, it's doing well.
It's doing really well
already, right?
Yeah, $123,000.
So I don't know. I mean, it could be awesome. I'm just saying, like, it's just, you know.
So, I mean, I've never seen the show, so I'm not going to spend the money on it, but I would play it, and I trust Jay and Sen, so I bet it's good. I mean, honestly, my money is on it's a good game, whether it's the best use of the theme or not. I mean, it won't offend me because I've never seen it, but you could yeah, be right. Exactly. I've definitely failed
working
on an IP before, so it's hard to do.
No, I get it. And Jay and Sen have done like other games for IDW and also other IPs, so mm-hmm. at least they're used to it, and they know what maybe has worked and hasn't worked. But I their previous IP games haven't really blown up yet, so maybe this is the one. Maybe I'm just wrong, but this is just not my type of game anyway. I mean, it's a tactical like fighting game, right? So for me, it's not like the thing that's going to get me into it, whereas I would have loved to like be in the world, you know, the actual world of it.
I'm gonna Kirkman this for a second and go inside baseball on IP games a little bit.
Please.
Oh,
as a designer, you're never going to throw a situation under the bus. You're generally just going to take it on the chin because you like working with publishers and you're never going to burn bridges.
Oh yeah.
I will say there's limitations that always come with these IP games, and you're never allowed to use those as a crutch when people get ticked off about certain things.
Yeah.
You just have to sit there and seethe and say things to yourself like,
so
I was contracted to make an arena battle game in the Korra universe type of thing. you don't know what the scope was. They might not have had carte blanche in the universe. That happens all the time from my experience. Maybe you get hired to make a 120 card game and somebody puts it in a $40 box full of air, and now people are wondering why they spent $40 on it when really it should have been a hangy box. You know what I'm saying? Like, stuff like that happens.
Stuff like that happens. And I'm totally down with that, right? Like, and that's why I look at it and I go, hey, if you're really into Korra, I think this looks like a game that's going to be right up your alley. But like, for someone like me who doesn't really know too much about Korra, I don't think this is going to get you on the board. You're going for the IP.
That's fair.
But at the same time, hey, I totally understand if like they were kind of pinholed into doing an arena battle game, right, as opposed to like an awesome Legend of Karak or a big world adventure game. And yeah, so it is what it is. But at the same time, cool.
I bet it's good because I trust those guys. And I just want to say, it appears they might have had the same graphic designer as Dragon Island. I mean, I don't know, based on the. I don't know what's with the bucket fill paint border thing going on right now. I thought we were past that.
I was trying to talk around it, but you got right to it. You know, that's good. I'm glad that you're here because I enjoy telling talk around.
Ugly. They're not the artist. Like, I mean, that would be a little frustrating. I really love those guys and they're great designers and they bucket filled the borders on the cards. I don't understand. Like, put some gradient in there, like a texture, a little border thingy. Like, why is it the bucket? I don't get it. I don't know. I'm sure it's great though. I love those guys. They're great designers, legitimately.
No. And that's the saving grace, right? So we could be negative all day, but like, yeah. Anyway, yeah,
exactly. What's next on the?
What's yeah, next?
Keep going.
Do you know what's next? World what? In Flames is next.
This is the game, the penis box game?
The penis box game. That's exactly right, PC.
And they brought up the collector's edition?
It is the collector's edition of one of the most famous war games of all time. And if you ever want to know if Grognards will still pay for stuff, the World in Flames collector's edition, which cost $118, has made $91,000 on Kickstarter. To be honest with you, that is awesome. No, I know. Ben's going, okay. But come on. This is classic, man. This is like, if anything is going to make $91,000, if I can just say I'm glad anything is making $91,000 on Kickstarter, it is World in Flames. Because by God, that is old school gaming right there to make $91,000 on Kickstarter. But here's the thing. It's made $91,000 on Kickstarter, but it's only been backed by 287 people.
Wow.
I know, right? You want to talk about some logistics behind all this? I mean, we're looking at like 200 backers for the $299 version, which is $238 It's the deluxe version of World in Flames. You get planes in flames. You get ships in flames. You get divisions in flames and territories in flames. Everything is in flames.
And this sounds like sounds like metalcore heaven.
It's amazing, but it is one of those really, really amazing war games that has been in print forever. But now you've got your definitive deluxe version. If you love World in Flames, if you want to be in flames while you're playing a war game, this is your game. It's amazing.
Oh, why didn't they change the cover? Come on.
Well, I mean, you can't. I mean, that's part of the selling thing. You gotta have the, you know, the. On the cover, what can I say? I'm gonna have to beep that, but it's so worth it.
All right, so here's the thing that's scary though. It's like the nobody knows nothing about nothing syndrome. You got, like, you know, as you describe it, the phallic cover making 100,000 on Kickstarter, and it's like, I got a game going up October 17th with you and Matt and the whole team, and we've got darn near 3 years into this thing, right?
Yep.
We got 3 years of design work, testing. It's got miniatures. It's got art. It's got the whole show. And I'll be honest, if it doesn't hit with players and people don't want it like I want them to want it, I mean, I'm going to be depressed. I'll just be honest. Like, because
we're all going to be depressed.
Man.
It's true.
You just don't know, right? I mean, you try to hit all the buttons and apparently you just put a shaft on a cover from a 30-year-old game, and that's, we could have just done that and made 100,000. Like, well, if you, I, who knew? I
mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to be honest with you, Ben. If that happens to us in Legends of Sleepy Hollow, I'm just going and finding old properties like this and just throwing them up. I don't care.
I'm telling you.
I'm done.
That will be the universe telling us not to work together.
It'll be the universe telling me that I just shouldn't work on, like, new properties. I should just go and find old stuff that people want, and I won't have to spend my... You don't have to spend 2-3 years of your time doing stuff. I don't have to do the same thing. We don't have to, like, spend all of our time making miniatures and art and all this other stuff. I'm just going to go find, like... something that I can just throw up on Kickstarter and make a quick buck off of. But I'm not saying that the World in Flames is like that. Because
just retheme Sleepy Hollow as Castlevania if it doesn't work.
Yeah, we could do that.
That would be pretty sweet.
Maybe. We'll see about getting that license, and then we'll relaunch it. And that might be all right.
Not rule that out. I don't know offhand. I mean.
That's a good suggestion, TC. We'll give you a little small cut for that. All right. So last on my list is one that has been up before, but is now in the hands of our friends at Floodgate Games, and that is News at 11, which is from Infectious Play Productions, most notably John Gilmore. But it brings in, basically, you're trying to tell the news. We have an old, I guess about a year and a half ago, when Dan and I had John on, and we played News at 11, and did the whole newscast thing, and it was so much fun. So you should go check that out right now. It's called News at 11. That is the at sign, like you would be on Twitter, on Kickstarter, and they have $8,000 of their $11,000 goal with 16 days to go, so go and check that out. So great, great team for this. Dice Hate Me Games news. Clubhouse has shipped. Yay! Hopefully, all of you have gotten your copies of Clubhouse at this point.
Hey, I was trying to put the sleeve cards in the box. I'm just kidding with
this.
Don't get me started. We're getting the same crap. We're getting the same crap on WEDS. You're getting like $40 worth of free trays in the game, and I got people complaining because the sleeve cards don't fit in the trays. Well, then don't use the trays. Just put the sleeve cards in the box. They still fit. I don't understand.
I don't even. No. Can't do it.
Move on.
Can't do it. No. You'll make me have an aneurysm here. Okay. So, like we mentioned last podcast, the Bottom of the Ninth app from Handelabra is now live. Look for it in the App Store on Google Play. It'll be up on Steam before too long. We also will have a release of the solo mode, which has the kind of campaign mode you can play solo with the app pretty soon. It's going to be awesome. Fate of the Elder Gods is out there in people's hands. We had lots of great plays of it this past weekend. We've had so many people say they enjoy the game. So please, if you're out there and you love the game, rate it on BGG, give us a review, write something really quick and post it on Board Game Geek, spread it to forums far and wide. Just please get the word of the game out there, because so many people are enjoying it, but it's been a little more on the quiet side. We want to get up there in the hotness, and we want to get people enjoying this so we can work on some expansion material that Richard and Daryl and I have been talking about.
I rated it a 9, legitimately.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So, you know, if you've played Fate, feel free to let them know about it. It really means a lot to creators. You know,
it does.
The negativity saps a lot out of us, so we really do. Everyone says they don't watch ratings, but we all do. We stalk them every day. So yeah. Go give these guys some good ratings if you like the game. They deserve it. The game deserves it. It deserves the visibility. 8s, 9s, and 10s are recommended. Just saying. It's a great girl game with minis. Look at everything that's in the box. Think about it hard. And if you didn't like it, feel free to keep it to yourself. You know what I mean? What the heck?
I 100% back up everything Ben just said.
And if you happen to be, you know, browsing Board Game Geek, even if you haven't played Spires or own it, you should probably give Spires a really good rating. Now, technically, you might be thinking to yourself, oh, it's just a card game, so it's a small card game, so I'll probably start my rating system at a 6. And I'll go up and down from there. What you should do is think, oh man, I'm probably going to get a really good value for my money because I can play it many, many times. Start with an 8, yep, and then go up or down from there. You know, I would say more upside. And like Ben said, keep it to yourself if you want to go down lower.
I agree.
Yes.
I think that is great advice. 100% concur. That's right. All right.
So go to Fate of Elder Gods, and then if you have time, check out Spires.
Yeah, only if you have time. But if you have time, yeah, of course, check out Spires. Unpub news. Daryl's not here, but you've heard on previous podcasts, Unpub Midwest is happening. So go and check out tickets on sale there at unpub.net. Also, of course, the Unpub 8 dates are March 23rd through the 25th of 2018. All of the designer tables are sold out of that right now, but that's okay because you can still come and have a great time. We are in a resort, so we have nowhere to go. So even if the tables are done, we're going to be playtesting stuff to 4 a.m. So come on out, get your game in front of people, because let's put it this way. People are going to have tables, and they're going to be playtesting. By the time they're done, they're not going to want to touch their game again until the next day, and they're going to want to play your game. So come on out after hours. You're going to have all the designers. You're going to have tons of people who are around wanting to play your game. So make sure you're there in Baltimore for Unpub 8. More information about that on unpub.net with VIP Matt Leacock. Hey, Ben, Fleeple's news?
Yeah, so we were joking, but in all seriousness, we got Legends of Sleepy Hollow coming out October 17th to Kickstarter, unless I can convince Chris to do Friday the 13th, which would be way cooler, but I don't know.
We'll see.
No, but for real. We've got years into this game, and we've put everything we have into this game, design-wise, component-wise, art-wise. Chris and the team at Greater Than is knocking it out of the park. I mean, these sculpts, the sculptor we have is off the chain. I mean, he's doing some of the best faces and like detail that I've seen. From what I've seen so far, it's amazing. It's a campaign-based game, but you don't need the GM. You talk about Hero Quest and things like that. You always needed the GM, right, to run the game. Well, in this one, you don't need that. So it's a co-op campaign with a lot of surprises, a lot of twists. You're going to build characters over the course of the chapters. You're going to level up your characters, get new swag, new skills, and new items. And it's going to be a riot. Meet us there October 18th. We'd love your support. Other than that, yeah, WEDS, Wasteland Express Delivery Service, has been going great. Go buy it. Give it a 9 on BGG, please. I'm sorry. We're working on expansion stuff. I mean, honestly, Nathan's been keeping us busy. Nathan and Molly at Pandasaurus, they're doing these in-store events, which is kind of a cool idea. They're trying to support the local stores by having these like one-off campaigns that the stores are going to host. He's calling it the scrappening, because scrap is the money in the game, old washers. Right. So basically, like a normal game of WEDS takes like 90 minutes if you know what you're doing. Well, these one-off store events are going to take like 2 or 3 hours, because there's like going to be this, you know, crazy deck of things that happens, and you go through and you do, it's like a one-off thing that you do, and then people might go home with a little swag, you know, if they participate in the event. So we've been doing a lot of those for Pandasaurus, for WEDS. And I guess the last thing we got coming out this year is you're going to hear a lot of the fanfare once Rio Grande gets their marketing engine rolling. You know, they do a lot of rollout for their titles.
Right.
So you'll be hearing it soon. And then when you see
it's going to be all over the place, splashed everywhere. Right,
the images are going to dominate the hotness. I would anticipate for Beta Colony, or the big, I would say the big Rio Grande release, along with Santa's Workshop from our buddy Keith Ferguson. Right. Those are the two huge Rio Grande releases coming out later this year. Beta Colony is ours. The Santa's Workshop is Keith's. But yeah, you should be hearing the hype machine rolling pretty soon from Rio Grande on that. They do a lot of marketing and podcasting and different grassroots efforts.
I
stuff
can't
like that.
Wait so, to hear Jay on every podcast I listen to. It's going to be amazing.
So that's Beta Colony. When you see like the massive thing, I think they have like a Monday Night Football commercial or something coming out for it. Or like when you see that, that's us. That's our game. So that's really exciting. We've literally pitched Rio Grande for like 5 years straight at every convention. And that's led us to Beta Colony. So that's a thing. Here's the deal. It's got the Roll Dell. This is the first official Roll Dell to hit the market. We've had a couple Roll Dells kicking around. That is a dice rondel, for those not familiar with this. So a rondel action selection system, but you roll dice to move around. Instead of being like in Navigador, you can move like up to 3, I think, around the rondel. Well, in this Roll Dell, the evolution of the rondel, you roll dice to tell you how far you can move, with modifiers, you know, plus or minus, like Castles of Burgundy. We just stole that because it works. And then you use a second die to activate the spot. So you move with a die and then you activate with another die. It's going to be a game changer. And, you know, it's beautiful. It's just, it rivals any visual game we've put out there ever. So I, you know, I would get it for that if nothing else. It's going to be great. That's all I can.
Ooh, wow.
Oh man, wow.
Man,
okay, for everyone,
I can't beat that passive aggressiveness.
Yeah, I was gonna say, man.
For the listeners at home, that was a little bit of a passive aggressive rant.
Maybe just a little. Maybe just a little.
My I feel like I should do one too, but you can pick up Spires. You can pick up Spires, which is a new game from TC Petty. You should probably do that because there's, you know, a few copies left.
Mostly, I think, what did Miniature Market buy them? I don't know.
Because it was super popular, and that's why they're all gone. No other reason. But if you'd like to go to your friendly local game store and request one, you can for a little bit until they're gone. But you should support Spires as much as possible.
That's right.
I'm a client. I just played it, actually.
Yeah. See?
I got my copy. I'm responsible. Anything else from you, TC? Besides, do you want to plug your playtesting?
I'll bring that up. Let's just do it now, right? Okay. So I'm TC Petty III. You can find me on Twitter at Puppy Shogun. And I also am doing some part-time game development for Artana. So if you'd like to get on the mailing list for that, you can check out hello@artana.com. That's ARTANA.com. And send them an email, ask if you'd like to be on the mailing list, and you'll get a chance to do all the little print and plays that we have for any games that are upcoming. And I'll be doing development and stuff, so you can talk to me, and it'll be cool. I also do the deep design segment on the Perfect Information podcast, which I haven't had a chance to do recently, but I'll be getting back into doing it in a little bit here.
Well, that's it for this episode of State of Games. We'll be back next time with even more great board game discussion, and we love hearing from all of you. If you have any topics or new segments you'd like to hear about, we can add them to the show. You can email those ideas to thestateofgames@gmail.com or tweet them at @thestateofgames. You can also go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast or join Guild 1903 on BoardGameGeek.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter at @dicehateme and on Instagram, where I'm close to 800 followers, which is awesome. TC, you mentioned where you could be found and what you would be playtesting. Ben, what about you?
Mostly Twitter. @pinchback21 is me. And if you have a rules question, or if you want to just tell us how awesome one of our games are, we do stock the forums for all our games at BGG. We subscribe to all of our games over on Board Game Geek, so we are very active in the forums. We try to stay out of the strategy, you know, type of things, let people explore the games themselves. But if you have a legitimate rules question, we'll meet you over there, or otherwise it's all Twitter all the time.
Awesome. Well, until next time, I'm Dice Hate Me.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm Pinchback 21.
Saying thanks for listening, and May all be sixes.
Woo! Yeah! I bet that comes out perfect. Secret raiders who will neutralize. Soon as they arrive.